celebrate July 4th, we have a show about Jews across America. And when I think of America, I think of
America.
Yeah.
This has been your obscenity warning. I think for the 4th of July episode, which this is, we should come up with American names.
American names. Hi.
Hi, I'm Mark Opportunity.
I'm Mark Brockwell. Oh, I thought you just meant a really Anglo name.
I'm Mark Brockwell. Joined here by Stephanie.
Do it. I dare you.
By Stephanie Buick.
And Lon Lockwood.
Lon Lockwood.
For the 4th of July, we are taking you across the United States of America. This is our Jews Across America episode. We've been talking about it for a while. We thought that for this country that we love in a complicated but profound and ultimately passionate way, that we would take you across the United States. And our producer, Shira Talushkin, had an idea. And we thought we'd pull her into the studio right now to tell us about this idea. What are we doing for this episode, Shira?
So when we were looking at the calendar a couple months ago, we were looking at July 4th. And one of the things that Josh and I and all of us were thinking about was, when you say that you're a Jew from America, or what it means to be Jewish in America, it means 1,008 different things. So I wanted us to get out there and talk to a bunch of different people and see what it means for them when they say that they're a Jew living in America, because that's a really different experience.
From sea to shining sea.
Coast to coast. And I'll say that, like, the idea was both geographical diversity, right? So who are people living in places we don't think of as Jewish, but also just like we Sephardic Jews, different types of ideological Jewish communities, different, you know, ethnic heritages or whatever.
Awesome. Okay. Now, to kick us off, you thought that maybe you would quiz us on just how much we know.
Right. So I thought it'd be sort of fun for News of the Jews to get a little historical. Basically, like, Jewish history in America is kind of crazy, right? So in 1750, there's only 300 Jews or about 60 families in all of New York. In 1800, there was 8 synagogues in the entire country. And then we get, by the end of the 1800s, is when we have, like, the huge Jewish community explosions.
When the Jews come.
Yeah, just hundreds of thousands
of people.
All of a
sudden, we're lousy with them.
All right, so embarrass us with some questions we would never, ever get right.
So first, we're just going to start with the basics. You guys get some softballs. What's the oldest congregation in the U.S., and where are they currently located?
The Portuguese-Spanish synagogue on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik.
What street?
Oh, come on now.
So Shaaret Israel was established in 1654, and they're now on 70th and Central Park West. All right, so before we get out of New York, which important New York building was built over the ruins of a kosher slaughterhouse? I actually told this to Liel, so he's out for this round.
I don't remember.
A, Madison Square Garden. B, the United Nations. C, the Empire State Building. Or D, the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Madison Square Garden.
I don't remember what you told me. I'm going to go UN.
I'll go UN also.
The United Nations built over a kosher slaughterhouse, which felt very symbolic.
Yeah, that's symbolic.
Right?
We're going to obliterate your particularity with our
screwing over Israel.
Oh, no, it's more like, oh, we're all about peace, like on this site of like murdering animals. I don't know.
That's how you read it, Talushkin.
Yeah,
all right, what else you got for us?
In 1935, Newsweek declared this sport to be one, quote, at which Jews particularly excel.
Football.
Baseball.
Boxing.
Basketball. The 1934 NYU City College Final Playoffs, which were a huge deal. In basketball, 9 of the 10 starters were Jewish. It was the Jewish sport. So this has an America and Upper West Side and Southern Jewish tie-in. For whom is the Israeli city of Netanya named?
I'll sit this one out because you did tell me the answer to that.
All right.
Tanya Hardik.
Natanya. Oh my God.
That's all I got.
Can I just say, from now on, if it wasn't named after her, we're going to write a letter. Natanya, listen, man.
All right. No, that would be amazing. Is Tanya Harding Jewish?
No.
No figure skater ever was Jewish. Sasha Baron Cohen's a figure skater?
Russian Jews. Okay. So the city of Netanya is named for Nathan Strauss, who, along with his brother Isidore Strauss, became the co-owners of Macy's.
I'm related to them.
Oh my God. Okay, wait. Let me finish and let's talk about this.
Yeah.
So they like huge baked goods, dried goods store,
yeah,
like Macy's. So they became the co-owners of Macy's in 1896. The brothers grew up in Georgia. They came from Bavaria, moved to the South. After the Civil War, they moved to New York. Now, Isidore and his wife, Ida, are sort of famous because they died on the Titanic together,
right,
after Ida refused to accept a spot in a lifeboat and chose to die with her husband. Right. So in the movie, when you have that shot of that old couple in the bed, it's Isidore and Ida Strauss.
Whoa.
There's a park named after them, mm-hmm, on 107th and West End, and lots of schools. And his brother, Nathan Strauss, is what the city of Netanya is named after.
That I didn't know.
Mark, do you get free clothes?
No, but I have told you, right, that I get the Strauss Family Historical Society newsletter, which is like, your seventh cousin twice removed
is rich.
Is right, people, money that will never find its
people
way to you.
People whose wills you're not in.
Well, no. What's sad about the Historical Society letters of an old family is now it's like, little Jacob Strauss Krieger graduated fourth in his class at Newton South. It's like the most banal. Like, it's all we're right, just boring Americans now.
Mark,
can I do mine,
yeah,
for them? Can I ask them?
Yeah, yeah. Do you have it?
So I have one for you guys, right? Which of the following coffee chains was not founded by a Jew? Starbucks, Pete's, Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay, I know Starbucks and Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf are definitely founded by Jews. Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf is the one that's in Israel, right?
I'm going to go Starbucks. I don't think the original founder was Jewish.
No, they were.
I think Howard Schultz took over from...
No,
so your answer
founders,
is Starbucks?
The founders were Jewish.
Well, she's now...
Well, I mean, I like... Okay.
Okay, I'm going to go Dunkin' Donuts. Although that's probably wrong.
I got to go... Then what's left? Pete's Coffee?
Pete's.
Okay, yeah. Who wins?
So, in fact, you win. Pete's was founded by the Dutch American coffee roaster Johannes. What was it? I sent you the name. Do you have it there?
Alfred Pete.
Alfred Pete. Now, Starbucks was founded by three people, one of whom was like Tzvika Kriegel or something. The other two,
Zev Siegel.
The other two, I'm not sure about. Dunkin' Donuts, founded in Canton, Massachusetts, in Goyesha, Eastern Mass.
The Heartland.
William Rosenberg was the founder of Dunkin' Donuts.
I thought that Pete's Coffee was founded by Amanda Pete, who is also Jewish.
Also Jewish. No, Pete Rosenberg.
That great
the DJ.
Children's book. We'll just keep
all right,
counting.
One, we got time for one more, Shira. What you got
so
for us?
We'll just do these quickly. These are just like guess that Jew names.
Okay.
All right. So Eric Weiss, son of Hungarian immigrant.
Oh, Houdini.
Beautiful.
I did not know that. So wait, we're guessing people's
yeah,
what they changed their name to.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's Eric Weiss.
And his dad was a rabbi in what state? Houdini's
New York,
Massachusetts,
Pennsylvania,
Wisconsin.
Nice.
All right, let's do another easy one just for people who don't know their history. Alan Stewart Kornsberg.
Woody Allen.
What was Lauren Bacall's original name?
Oh, I think I actually did know this
one. Bat Rachel Bach.
Was there a Horowitz in there?
Betty Joan Persky.
Betty Joan Persky.
Amazing.
All right, so let's end off. This is always my fave. This is the one I sent out to Slack, so off you guys if you know it. Alyssa Zinnenyeva Rosenbaum became what famous writer?
I love this one so much because I didn't know it until you sent it.
I have no
idea. The hint is it's Paul Ryan's dream date.
Oh, there we go. Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand.
It's what every like weird boy... tells you it's his favorite.
Born Alyssa Rosenberg.
Rosenbaum.
Yes. That's amazing. Sure,
all right, guys. Happy July 4th.
Thank you.
Thank you for curating this episode of Jews Across America.
I am here with Stuart Rockhoff. He's the executive director of the Mississippi Humanities Council, and he spent more than 11 years as director of history at the Institute of Southern Jewish Life in Jackson, Mississippi. There, he was responsible for creating this amazing resource, the Encyclopedia of Southern Jewish Communities. And he's from Texas, but now he's over in Mississippi. Welcome, Stuart.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. It's my pleasure to be here.
So I'm a little bit obsessed with Jews of the South. I am from New York. I went to college in Durham and sort of became a little bit obsessed with the Jewish history there. Like, what's your favorite town, your favorite pocket of Jewish life, either now or historically? Like, what's your favorite story?
Oh my gosh, there's so many great stories. I'll take one from North Carolina, because there's this assumption that Jews in the South must have, kind of hidden away, in sort of in their basements and not been public about it, when in fact, when you go back and you look at when Jews settle in the South and they build synagogues, these are big public events. They draw big crowds. They draw elected officials. And one of my favorite examples, in fact, comes from North Carolina. And it was a small town where Jews had settled there, and they were trying to build a synagogue. And they actually sent out a fundraising letter to Jews in other towns sort of around that part of the South saying that, listen, you need to help us. We need to have a synagogue. In order to be accepted in the community, we need to have a proper house of worship. So then for them, building a synagogue was a way of assimilating into the culture of the town in which everybody goes to church, in which faith is very important. So, you know, I use that kind of example to show how Jews, you know, fit themselves into the cultures of the South.
The best thing about this encyclopedia is basically you click on a state and then it brings down like a drop menu of all of these different communities. And so you can really, really, really go very, very deep on, you know, I'm going to see what I have open right now. Oh, I have Galveston open. I have Memphis. Sure. I have Chickasha, Oklahoma open.
Chickasha.
Oh my God. This, I'm showing my Northern arrogance.
Yeah. I've been to all those places. So as I did the research, you know, I would visit most of these communities, and I had a few tricks. So the first thing I would do is I would go into a cemetery. Well, I'd find the Jewish cemetery and I'd write down names, because one of the hard things is our census never collected who was Jewish and who wasn't. So you had to kind of try to estimate or guess. But if someone's buried in a Jewish cemetery, chances are they're Jewish. And so I would then take those names to the library and go through old city directories and go through old newspapers and, you know, kind of piece by piece, kind of put together a history of that community. And if there's still Jews there, I would meet with them. If there was still a synagogue, I would go and dig through closets and find whatever information I could to tell that story. One of the challenges I found, Stephanie, was that so many of these communities had very similar stories. So I was trying to find what is unique about this, you know, this place, say like Chickasha, or what is unique about, say, Laredo, Texas. That one's actually very unique because it's on the border. But, you know, one of the challenges was to write the stories of each communities and do it in a way that, you know, wasn't sort of, you know, kind of repetitive. You know, Jews arrived, they opened stores, they built the, you know, synagogue, they assimilated, et cetera, et cetera. So you definitely saw patterns.
I mean, one of those patterns seems to be like the dry goods store.
Right.
Why were, I mean, were Jews were merchants. And could you tell, like, why was it that a Jew would come to it, like the Jewish community would come in or Jewish merchants would come in and then just like open a dry goods store?
Sure. So there is an old joke, which that no town ever had a first Jew because that Jew always had a cousin who was there first. So, you know, Jews arrive in the South in significant numbers beginning in sort of the mid-19th century. And, you know, they're coming from Europe. They are, for the most part, working as peddlers initially and very much created Jewish ethnic networks, economic networks. So in this part of the South, in the Deep South, oftentimes New Orleans was the hub. So sort of newly arrived immigrants would arrive in New Orleans. Perhaps they would be outfitted with their first pack of merchandise from a Jewish wholesaler, and then they would start traveling, walking, or riding horse if they were successful, up the river into these small towns. And the great thing about being a peddler is you could scout. So if you arrived in a place and noticed that there was a store for sale or there was a lack of stores, then you could use those same relationships with the wholesalers in New Orleans and other Jews in other places to establish a business. And so, you know, you had, that's kind of the universal story of Jews in the South, is they arrive in towns and they establish businesses. So one of my other tricks, so when I researched, is I would look in the newspaper around the time of the high holidays, and I would look for the ads. And the ads would say, so-and-so store will be closed on Thursday for a religious holiday. That was another indicator that this was a Jewish-owned store. It was very interesting because sometimes it would say, our store will be closed on Saturday, September 22nd for a Jewish holiday, which told me they closed for Rosh Hashanah, but they were usually open on Saturdays for the Sabbath. So again, it shows how Jewish religious practice evolved and changed in the South to fit those circumstances.
I'm curious about the way these Jewish communities were forming alongside, I imagine, very, very, very long, you know, these deep Christian traditions. And is there a way in which Southern Judaism just looks different because it was so enmeshed with this like larger Christian culture?
You know, over time, yeah. I mean, initially you had, you know, Jews who arrived in the South in the mid-19th century were what we would call sort of traditional or Orthodox Jews. Even here in Jackson, they employed a shochet. So having kosher meat was important. That didn't last all too long, one, because it could be hard to get a shochet, it could be hard to get kosher meat. And as I said, if you're in retail trade, especially in these southern towns, Saturday was the big day for business. Saturday was the day that the farmers in the surrounding areas would come to town to buy their stuff. So if you were not going to be open on Saturday, you were not going to be open for very long. So that was a kind of a quick adjustment. So when Reform Judaism kind of gets established in the United States in the late 19th century, they find especially fertile soil in the South. And so at a time here in Mississippi, by the early 20th century, most, I think about three quarters of the congregations here were affiliated with the Reform movement. And even today, a Southern Jewish congregation is twice as likely to be Reform as a congregation in another part of the country. And I think that had to do with, you know, kind of fitting in. It had to do with, you know, the difficulties of finding kosher meat, the impracticality for many of maintaining an Orthodox Sabbath when you were in commercial business. And so all of that fed into the prominence of Reform Judaism, and they were cultivated. So, you know, Isaac Meir Wise shows up at a lot of these synagogue dedications. So, you know, for him, he noticed that the South was fertile soil, and he cultivated it.
But there are some Orthodox communities in the South, right? Like, I know a lot of the one people know often is Memphis. But are there?
Yeah, Memphis
are there...
is really interesting, right? So certainly in the larger cities, you absolutely have Orthodox congregations. Memphis is unusual because it has a very large Orthodox congregation. It's called Baron Hirsch. They you know, self-declare as the largest Orthodox congregation in America. I haven't been able to verify that, but it's about 500 families. So you know, it is very significant. That's kind of an outlier. I mean, oftentimes, the Orthodox congregations, especially in the smaller communities, you know, eventually moved away. Some became conservative, and so on.
One of the very cool things on the encyclopedia is this list of Southern Jewish mayors.
Ah, yeah.
And I was surprised to see that, like, Montgomery had a Jewish mayor in 1887. Like, Jews, right, were they able to rise to positions of political power?
So in these small towns back in the 19th century, and even really today, what class of people get involved in local politics? It's local civic leaders. It's local business leaders. It's the downtown chamber of commerce folks. So Jews, as business owners, got very involved in these civic organizations. They got very involved in sort of local leadership projects. And so for many, that flowed into politics, into being elected mayor. Even today, we have a Jewish mayor in Rolling Fork, Mississippi, and a Jewish mayor in Indianola, Mississippi. And let me just tell you that you can count the Jewish population of those towns on my fingers. And yet, you know, these are respected local business people. They've been in the community a long time. And so that's sort of a long tradition of that. One of my favorite examples is actually from Rolling Fork. There's a man named Sam Rosenthal, who was mayor of Rolling Fork from the mid-1920s to 1969. It's about 45 years as mayor. And granted, being mayor of Rolling Fork, Mississippi is not the same as being mayor of, say, New York City. It's not a full-time job. But he was a very, very important leader in that small town. And think about the social changes that take place in a place like Mississippi, a place like Mississippi Delta, between the 1920s and the late 1960s. So he, you know, was there during a time of tremendous change.
And even before that, something that really was amazing to me. So Little Rock had a Jewish mayor named Jonas Levy from 1860 to 1864. So during the Civil War. So can you tell us a little bit about what was going on? Like, I think people, when we think about the Civil War, I think it's easy to sort of not think about Jews, or maybe to know about, you know, just a few random stories. But how did the Jews of the South relate to the Jews of the North before and during the Civil War?
Sure. So, I mean, there's different evidence of this. I mean, in a place like Charleston, which had a long-standing Jewish community that was fairly well established, and here's a fact that will blow people's minds. In 1820, more Jews lived in Charleston, South Carolina than lived in New York City. Now that's 1820, wow. But 1830, that changed and it never came back. So in places like Charleston, you had Jewish communities that where many of its residents had been born there. They've been raised as Southerners, as white Southerners. And so they acted like other white Southerners. So you've got plenty of examples of Southern Jews who were sincere, faithful defenders of the Confederacy, both in terms of taking up arms and serving in the military, and also, and you know, there are rabbis who are sermonizing that the cause of the Confederacy was moral and just. You also have, you know, newly arriving Jewish immigrants coming from Central Europe who are settling, who are not well established. They, you know, maybe don't own, you know, well, you know, don't own land, don't own slaves, who are perhaps less attached to it. So you had kind of the gamut. Once the Civil War is over, Jews seem to kind of get over it. Jews in the South seem to get over it fairly quickly. So you don't have the sort of, you know, sense of loss and tragedy that much of the white South felt after the Civil War. You know, Jews kind of picked back up and kind of kept going.
So Jews owned slaves is what you're saying.
Sure. And so the basic thing to understand about Jews in the South and slavery is that there was not a distinctly Jewish response to slavery. Jews in the South that were economically established, that had the means to acquire slaves, generally did. Those that didn't, did not. So it wasn't sort of a moral question. So Jews owned slaves in a place like Charleston at about the same rate as non-Jews. They tended not to own plantations. They tended to live in cities. So these were servants. But, you know, it's important to understand that the kind of theological debates over slavery that played out in the Christian church also played out within Judaism. And you have rabbis from the north, from New York, in fact, who argued that, you know, according to the Torah, slavery is allowed. There's lots of rules about slavery sort of in the Torah. So it was a source of theological debate in the Jewish world as it was in the Christian world.
So could you tell us about a few, you know, specific pockets of Jewish communities that are particularly interesting or have, you know, really, really rich histories?
Well, I mean, of course, I'd say all of them, but one that really stood out to me, and we can debate whether this is the South, is the town of Laredo, Texas, which is right on the Mexico border. And what happened was once immigration restriction was passed in America in 1924, it became much harder for Jews in Europe to get into America. So a lot of them would come into Mexico and they would kind of work their way up, and a lot of them would cross the border. Back then, the border was much easier to cross than it is today. And they settled in places like Laredo. So you have this really unique Jewish community in Laredo that has a lot of Mexican heritage. I met with a guy who had a heavy kind of Yiddish inflected kind of Spanish accent and yet Texas accent. It was really interesting. And I met with a woman whose father owned a store that was called House of Raul, and he was named Raul, but actually it was a version of Israel. So they changed his name Israel to kind of Raul to fit in. But what was important was that that border was sort of insignificant. So folks would live on one side and own businesses in the other and cross the border every day. That, of course, has changed. But a really unique Jewish community that I sort of enjoyed visiting. And, of course, Bentonville, Arkansas is another one. You know, the kind of general trend in Southern Jewish life is small town communities are shrinking and dying, and the big cities are growing. So Atlanta is burgeoning. It's got, you know, well over 100,000 Jews and all this. Bentonville is the exception. So it's the small town of Northwest Arkansas that has seen in the last 20 years a newly created Jewish community, a newly created synagogue. And the reason for that is because it's the corporate home of Walmart. So Jews who work for Walmart or work for Walmart suppliers are moving to the small Arkansas town, and they have created a fledgling Jewish community.
It's like the modern dry goods store.
Well, it's sort of ironic, of course, right? Because a lot of those dry goods stores have been put out of business by the large retail chains. So to me, it's sort of the exception that proves the rule, and that Jews have moved out of retail trade for the most part, especially in small towns, because retail trade has kind of declined. And so it's the rise of big box stores. So I was driving through the Mississippi Delta last night and, you know, past the Walmart on the outskirts of a town. And if you go to that downtown square, you can see a lot of empty storefronts.
Wow. And so when these communities were started and over the years, was there a lot of, you know, interaction? There's some places where you sort of refer to like Jewish ghettos where the Jews sort of like all bought land in one area and lived sort of amongst themselves. How much of like a mixing of culture was there between Jews?
So when I moved to Jackson in 2002, there was, my backyard neighbor was Jewish, and around the corner there was a guy, a family who was Jewish. So we joked that we were the Lower East Side of Jackson, you know, three Jews in like a, you know, mile radius. So yeah, I mean, in larger cities, you had distinctly Jewish neighborhoods, places like Houston, places like Atlanta, of course, Memphis. But in small towns, there simply were not Jews to do that. And so Jews had to kind of, you know, mix into the community much more quickly. And so, you know, I always tell people, if you're opening a store in Yazoo City, Mississippi in 1910, you better learn how to speak English pretty quickly because all your customers are going to be speaking English. So that sort of Yiddish culture that really flourished in the large cities of the Northeast, you know, was much less the case in the South. Now, it did exist for sure, but it tended to be in the larger cities and not in the smaller towns.
And so what about a place like Dothan, Alabama, where we sort of have been reading news reports every few years that they're like paying young Jewish families to come settle there? Is that common?
No, Dothan was the pioneer in this. But you had someone with deep pockets who thought, you know, we are a shrinking congregation. We need families to move here. And the genius of the idea is that, you know, I mean, you don't need to bring in 100 families. If you bring in 5 families, that will ensure at least a generation of that Jewish community continuing. You know, one of the good barometers of the health of a Jewish community is the size of its religious school. Are there kids? And so I know that that program has been very successful in Dothan in terms of, you know, keeping young people there, keeping that religious school going. You know, is it a feasible model? You know, I'm not sure, but it's certainly one that's gotten a lot of attention.
So what are some other cities or towns who could use something like that? Like, let's say like some big funder is going to come and say, you know, like, I'm going to pay for people to go to 5 different places. What are those 5 places that are like most in need of a revitalized, you know, a good religious school?
I mean, I always say that you can tell as a city, as a community flourishes, so will its Jewish communities. So if economically, for example, I was talking about the Mississippi Delta, it was once the center of the Jewish community in Mississippi. You had towns, Jews settled in towns throughout the region. They had multiple synagogues in multiple towns. And that has just simply, you know, as the Delta has declined economically for a host of reasons, as the retailing trade has changed. I mean, you know, parents who live in Mississippi, Jewish parents raise their kids almost expecting them to go somewhere else. I mean, we work hard to give our children a sort of Jewish experience. So my kids go to a Jewish summer camp in Utica, Mississippi. That's been profoundly important to them. And the thought is that, you know, when they go away to college, when they're done, there's a good chance they're not coming back. So, you know, we don't raise our children to stay in a lot of ways. So you're saying which 5 towns could use Jews? Well, I mean, all of them, but then, you know, what's drawing them there? I know, for example, that several Southern University towns have made a special effort to attract Jews. So, for example, at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, they built a new synagogue on campus. And the university essentially gave them the land to do it.
Wow.
And the idea was that if we can make Jews feel more welcome here, we can attract better faculty, we can attract better students. So those college towns are kind of the interesting examples of small towns that have growing Jewish communities. So Auburn, Alabama has a new congregation or relatively new congregation. I've been, you know, keeping my fingers crossed for Oxford, Mississippi. They're kind of, you know, getting to that point where they could kind of organize. And so, you know, again, it's like the places that are attracting people are attracting Jews.
So let's say I'm taking a road trip to do a Jewish tour of the South. Like, what are the big stops? What are some places I shouldn't miss? Where should I be going?
Well, Jewish road trip is a good question because I just planned one for my college Yiddish teacher. So I got my graduate degree at the University of Texas, and my Yiddish professor, Itzik Gottesman, emailed me and said they were driving to Mississippi. What should they see? So I set them up, right? So I sent them to Greenwood, Mississippi, which has a very small but very dedicated Jewish community that, in fact, a congregation that had been founded as Orthodox and still identifies as traditional, and a really fascinating place. I sent them to Indianola, where the mayor, Steve Rosenthal, is Jewish and was the first mayoral candidate since the Voting Rights Act to win every precinct in Indianola. Now, what does that mean? It means he won both white and black votes, which was, you know, very extraordinary. I sent them up to Clarksdale, Mississippi, because of the blues history, but also there was a former congregation there and there's a historic cemetery. So, you know, basically, you know, I used to joke that if I was driving and my car broke down, I knew Jews everywhere. It actually came in handy once. I was driving outside Lafayette, Louisiana, and our car broke down. And I had had dinner at the president of the congregation's house like 4 years earlier. So I called her out of the blue and her husband came and helped us.
It's like AAA, but like for Jews only.
AAA, right. Triple J.
Stuart Rockoff, thank you so much. And we will hopefully get down to visit you in Jackson soon.
Great. Thanks a lot, Stephanie.
Thanks. We are on the line with Sammy Potter. He was the only Jewish kid in his high school in Yarmouth, Maine. And were you the only Jewish kid in your class or your school?
As far as I know, I was the only Jewish kid in my class. I very well may have been the only Jewish kid in my school, but there's definitely not a Jewish community by any means, so I probably wouldn't even know if there was other Jewish students in my school.
You guys don't do like the secret signal to each other?
We don't have the nod or anything like that, no.
When you were a senior, did you see like a freshman with really dark curly hair and you walked by him and kind of like gazed at him in the hallway?
Like,
and
shalom?
Sometimes I just yell shalom in the hallway and see who looks up.
So you're starting at Stanford in the fall, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Mazel tov. That's a nice
Thank
one.
Thank you very much.
So tell us, what's it like? You know, you're here, you're celebrating holidays, no one else is celebrating, you have all these stories and traditions no one else gets. Does it feel lonely, or are you kind of like the cool exotic one, like, hey man, it's Hanukkah, let me like drop some knowledge in you? What's it like?
I'd say it's a mixture of both. I definitely have taken some pride in sharing with my friends whenever I'm celebrating a holiday that they are treating as any other day. At the same time, though, it is something that's difficult. You know, anytime, especially as a child, I feel like you know, naturally we are pack animals, and our natural instinct, especially, you know, as children in elementary school and as middle school, is to fit in and want to be like others. And, you know, to have something that was immediately different about me, just because of, you know, how I was born wasn't something that was always appealing to me. But at the same time, having something that was immediately different and that I couldn't change, over time kind of made me more comfortable with being different. So I guess it ended up even socially being more or less a positive thing in my life, because I felt more comfortable doing things that weren't that were sort of against the grain. Just because in the beginning, you know, there was really no choice.
Although really amazingly, you could have, being the only Jew, you could have made up whatever you wanted. I mean,
it's like literally like the
Today
Book of Mormon.
Is the fast of Megatron, where we all take off our clothes and
I
sing
should
hymns.
Not be entrusted
like,
with.
Yeah.
That's like, wait, what is it? The Book of Mormon, he changes it to like the Book of whatever his name is, because he's like a missionary. And
do whatever you want. Okay, so tell us a little bit about Yarmouth, Maine. You know, about how big is it? What's the general vibe there? What's the big industry? How did your family get there? Tell us Yarmouth.
Yeah, sure. So Yarmouth is, I feel like I'm repeating one of my college essays right now.
Why okay. Stanford?
We don't know that.
No, I'm just kidding. So Yarmouth is kind of a little sleepy seaside New England town, very homogeneous. You know, Maine itself as a whole is the most homogeneous state in the country. And homogeneously white, that is. In Maine,
I'm going to tell South Dakota you said that, pal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we have a little competition with them every year. I think we surpassed them sometime in the 90s, and we haven't looked back since. Yeah, but it's definitely homogeneous in both its population and then also in its religious practice. So it's very much a Christian town with folks pretty regularly going to church on Sunday. You know, that kind of plays into the culture of the town. It's I'd say it is welcoming in theory to to other families. But so much of the community is built around, you know, not necessarily the religion itself, but the practices that come with it. So it is, you know, I have a few other friends who are who are minorities, and you know, I think for them it has been pretty difficult to fit in. Not because people are necessarily explicitly heinous to them, but just because there is something very difficult about, you know, for example, my friend who is the only African American in our grade. And because of that, I think it puts people in sort of a difficult position. And, you know, I honestly think that our town culture is somewhat worse off because of how homogeneous it is.
And so is there something about the town culture that you guys just didn't partake in because you were Jewish? Like, oh, everyone goes to the Lobster Shack after church, but we're going to sit that one out, something like that?
You know, it was interesting because on Sundays when I was growing up, I would go to Hebrew school. And most of my friends would go to church. And then, most of my friends after that would go to the park and, participate in like town soccer games. And I think that sort of made me feel left out when I was, honestly made me feel pretty left out when I was in elementary school. Cause you know, I was still in Hebrew school.
Where's the nearest Hebrew school?
It's like 45 minutes to an hour away, depending on traffic.
And that's, was that your synagogue?
Yeah.
So what town was that in?
South Portland.
You have to take a boat.
So do you feel like when you know, I know we have to let you go, but do you feel like when you leave for college, like you don't want to go back? Are you like sort of like ready to get the hell out of there? And also, like, what do you want other Jews to know about, you know, Jews who might live in more more Jewish populated areas who take for granted sort of like these ideas of Jewish community and Jewish solidarity? Like, what would you say to that?
Yeah, those are two really good questions. So to the first one, I would say, I think you asked, do I want to leave or do I want to come back? I absolutely want to come back. You know, even outside of being Jewish, Maine is despite some of the difficulties, Maine is the place in the world that I think has the most raw potential to be an amazing society and an amazing place for all types of people. I think there's so much potential that has been untapped here. And frankly, I actually want to spend the entirety of my life working to improve Maine and hopefully make it a welcoming place for all people. And then secondly, I think that what I'd like Jews in, especially like urban areas in the United States, one of the stigmas that comes from being a Jew within the Jewish community in a rural place like Maine is that we I think there's an assumption that we're much more you know, secular and not engaging in Judaism as Jews in urban areas. And, you know, that is true in a lot of cases. And I think am more secular as a result of living in a pretty rural suburban area. But at the same time, I really think there is a lot of value to Jews living in areas where there is not as many Jews.
Yeah. I'm ready to elect you governor.
Yeah,
especially can you take a gap year from
Sammy
Stanford?
Sammy Potter 2036.
Yeah, just well, go right? Be governor for a couple of years.
Especially
and then
given
do college.
Who their governor is. I mean, Maine has the craziest.
Oh my God,
they have
don't
Paul.
Even get me started
Paul
on that
Lafarge
governor.
Is that his name? He is literally the worst governor in the country.
I don't know. So I want this kid.
We want this kid. Sammy Potter. Final question for you. What was the family name before you changed it to the very Maine appropriate Potter?
My dad's name actually is Potter, but my mom's maiden name is Zarin.
Oh, okay. So dad's an old Maine Gentile?
My dad is an Episcopal from Concord, New Hampshire, actually.
Love it. Love it. Because Potter is like, if I was going to pick a name for a kid from Maine, it might be Potter.
Right. Sounds like we've been here forever, doesn't it?
It really is. Samuel Potter, I think he was like the minister of First Church on the Green.
It's actually Shmuel.
I'm pretty sure he came over on the Mayflower.
Shmuley Potter, thank you so much for being one of our Jews of the week. And Potter for governor 20.
And good luck at Stanford.
Yeah, good luck at Stanford. Stay in touch.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me.
Thank
and
you.
I really appreciate what you do.
All right. Likewise. Take care.
All right. Have a good one.
We are on the line with Jamila Bukai. She is a journalist living in New York, and she moved from San Antonio from Mexico City when she was 8 years old. Welcome.
Thank you.
To the show, not to America, obviously.
Not to America. Yeah. Good thing I've been here for a while.
So your family is Syrian, but when did your family get from Syria to Mexico?
So it's my dad's family, Syrian, and the way the communities are broken up in Mexico, you belong officially to the community of your dad. So even though my mom's Ashkenaz, I was completely enmeshed with the Syrians.
So what are the different communities in Mexico? So was your mother's family there as well?
Yeah, my mom's family was there. My mom spent a lot of her childhood in the U.S., but her family was in Mexico. There are currently four communities. They're divided along kind of ethnic lines, I guess is the closest word for it. So there's one community of Syrian Jews from Damascus, and those are the Shamis, which just means from Damascus. And there's the Syrian Jews from Aleppo, which are the Halevis. And then there's the Sephardi community, which is not the way we define it in the U.S., is just everything that's Ashkenaz, not Ashkenaz, it's Sephardi. In Mexico, Sephardi Jews are descended from people who spoke Ladino, mostly. The ones in Mexico came from Greece and Turkey, where I guess they were post-Spanish expulsion. And then there's the Ashkenaz, Kehila. And that just includes all European Jews. Although at one point there were different Ashkenaz communities. There was one for Hungarian Jews, one for French and German, but
yeah, I was about to say, I love how like Syria gets like two different communities for two different cities, and the whole continent of Europe is just like, you guys go here.
Yeah, it was a process of smooshing together.
You all look the same to me, you Ashkenazi Jews.
So what languages did you grow up speaking?
I grew up speaking Spanish, but I started learning Hebrew and like pre-K. There was Arabic interspersed a lot in our Spanish, which I didn't realize was not just part of Spanish until I moved to the U.S. Then I met people who spoke Spanish and they didn't understand some of my vocabulary. And I was like, oh, huh, I guess this is not fully Spanish. And I knew some Yiddishisms, not really very much at all, but that's like from my mom's family. And then once I moved to Texas, I started learning English.
So, Jamila, when you got to Texas, you were 8 years old, right? To San Antonio?
Yeah.
And I don't know how well you remember that. I don't remember 8 years old very well. But, you know, what was the biggest surprise or the biggest change when you moved from Mexico to the United States?
The biggest change by far was not having family around. I mean, I had my sisters and my parents. And so I guess by a lot of American standards, I had my nuclear family, and that was having family around. But growing up in Mexico City, I had three of my great-grandmothers within walking distance. I had my grandparents, who I saw every day. I had a lot of cousins, aunts, great-uncles, all within the same neighborhood of a few blocks. We would go eat at my grandma's house every week, twice a week on Fridays and Sundays. We would have Shabbat with my grandparents, play with my cousins, and That was not unique to my family. That's just like part and parcel of growing up Jewish in Mexico City, is that you have a huge extended family around you. And we didn't have that in the U.S. So that was just weird and difficult to adapt to.
So your Jewish community in the U.S. in San Antonio, what was that like? Was it largely Syrian Mexican Jews? Was it just Jews from Texas?
It was mostly Ashkenazi Jews from Texas. I mean, there is definitely diversity in the community in San Antonio. There are a few families from South Africa, a lot of Israeli families, a couple of other Mexican families. And I guess maybe my parents gravitated towards them, fellow immigrants. And in terms of our community, my parents put my sisters and I in the only Jewish school in San Antonio, which has since kind of closed down, or it's become a charter Hebrew school, so it's lost the religious element of it. But they put us in the school, and that was how we started having community. Our school friends, the parents of our school friends, and my parents also became parts of the Orthodox congregation, like the one Orthodox synagogue. There's also a Chabad synagogue, but it was the not Chabad Orthodox synagogue, because that was the closest to what our synagogue in Mexico.
Is that Ezra, your little baby?
Yeah, that
hey,
is.
Ezra. So Jamila, here's a question. When you first start to kind of like become enmeshed with the local community here, what strikes you as different? Not just, you know, different ways of living, but like when you start interacting with American Jews, how do they seem to you different than Mexican Jews?
Well, I think one of the biggest things was the difference between a congregation and a community. Like, we were affiliated with our synagogue, and sure, there were fundraisers and events, but it was primarily like a faith-based community. Whereas in Mexico, like, whatever community you belong to absorbs and fills in every part of your life.
It's a real mishpocha.
Yeah, there are ambulances organized by it. There are scholarships. There are schools that are run by the community. There are just all sorts of institutions that regulate your life for better or worse. Sometimes that can be suffocating. I think as a child, it wasn't quite as present in my mind. But they absorb all of you. And in Texas, that was not the case. Like, synagogue was the place where we went on Shabbat to pray and on some of the holidays. We still went to Mexico for most high holidays. The other thing that struck me as so different was there is not really a reform movement in Mexico at all. There's a little bit of conservative. It was a culture shock for me. And I don't know if that's so much the American part or just the different practice. Maybe like if I'd grown up in Crown Heights and I went to like a reform synagogue, I would have had the same reaction.
And so you're living in Great Neck right now, which is on Long Island, which is where I grew up. And that's like one of the big bastions of the Persian community, the Iranian Jews who came over in 79. There's LA and then there's Great Neck. So, and your husband's Persian, right?
Yeah. So it's been nice because there are some differences. Like during Passover, we stayed here. My parents came over because they just go wherever their grandchild is.
As they should.
Yeah. So we were with my in-laws, and during Dayenu, they took out leeks, everyone at the Seder, and started whipping each other with the leeks. And my parents and sisters and I just looked at each other like, what is going on? But other than that, like, the services are pretty similar. A lot of the extended family networks, the type of food, just it's like a very similar culture. So it's been pretty easy adaptation, barring the linguistic barriers, because I do not know Farsi.
Yeah, I feel like everyone speaks Farsi when they don't want you to hear.
Yeah, or the Shabbat table, which is really, like, I need to step up my Farsi game. I don't know if I'm going to tell them once I understand it. Maybe I'll just keep that to myself. So
Jamila, what, like, when we think about Syrian food and we think about Mexican food, those are different. But, like, what are some of the ways in which you grew up with just, like, a fusion of the two?
My grandma was an amazing cook. And one of the things that she would make in mass are kibbeh, which is just a staple of Syrian cooking. They're kind of like meatballs, but it's a disservice to call them that, as they're much more complex. And along with being able to dip them in hummus or tahina, we would also eat them with guacamole, which I think was even better.
Sounds like the best thing ever.
As we say in Yiddish, me gusta mucho.
Or Passover tacos with kosher tortillas, if you can eat quitneo.
Oh, I corn tortillas.
Oh, and I should say, ooh, Jamila, that my family, we're vegetarians, and so we obviously eat quitneo during Passover. There'd be nothing left to eat, and that sounds extraordinary. Jamila Bukai, a journalist living in New York, by way of San Antonio, by way of Mexico City, thank you for being on Unorthodox.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
Bye. So I sat down with Tirza Firestone, who is from Boulder, Colorado, and one of the founding members of the Jewish Renewal Movement, which is a fascinating, fascinating development in Jewish spiritual life.
Jewish Renewal is a Jewish movement that was founded by Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi in the late 1950s, early 60s, to reinvigorate a generation of Jews who had been, in a sense, disenfranchised or disinterested, had gone by the wayside, either to India to seek other spiritual forms and practices, or dropping out into the secular world. It came into being first as a healing to a very traumatized generation who were born in post-Holocaust era, and the mysticism had died, the sort of the deep heart had died because there was a dissociation that had gone on, this horrendous catastrophe that had happened. And nobody was dealing with it yet in the 50s and 60s. It was just, people were just starting to wake up to what had happened to us. So there was a waking up that happened in those decades. And so Jewish renewal came as a healing balm.
It is sometimes frowned upon by less than generous souls as a kind of modern day relative of the kind of, you know, Madonna Kabbalah, trendy. Tell me, you know, if you were to meet one of these skeptics, of which, by the way, as I will soon reveal, I'm absolutely not one, what would you say? I mean, it's easy to mistake the substance for the joyous, effervescent outside.
I think there is a Jewish light stereotype, L-I-T-E, which really irks me because personally, it really depends on the community and on the rabbi who's leading. If there's intellectual gravitas and there's really people studying, they're studying whatever it is, Talmud or Hasidic texts, Perushim, then that stereotype evaporates right away. The davening is given to a lot of song, a lot of music. Sometimes you will have, and maybe this is perhaps some of the stereotype, maybe not all six chapters of Tehillim, of Psalms, are read word for word on Kabbalat Shabbat. But there might be one phrase that's chanted again and again and again until the energy in the room shifts and there really is you're ready for Lachadudi.
Until, as they say in the Mishnah, until the chakras open.
Exactly. A lot of Jewish renewal rabbis come from Orthodox backgrounds. And so we know the scales. We play the scales very well. We know the kind of the template, the matbea of davening, of Jewish prayer, and then we get to riff. We make jazz out of it. It doesn't work so well if you don't have that grounding. So that's for one thing. So I come from a very deep and steeped yeshiva background from the Midwest. We're women, my family in Israel still, they just shake their heads and laugh because a woman rabbi is still just completely ridiculous to them. But what's anomalous about my story is that I went so far away from Yiddishkeit that I was really disaffected and was really running the other direction. I married a non-Jew who was actually a devout Christian. And it was through that intermarriage, and I was, by the way, disenfranchised. I was disowned by my Orthodox family. It was through that relationship that I started seeking again, because here was a person who was very devout Christian, and he knew all about Buber, and he knew more about mysticism, Jewish mysticism, than I did. So I slowly started to come back, be interested in my own birth religion, paradoxically. And then I met Reb Zalman, and Reb Zalman said, "It's okay. It's okay that you're intermarried. You still belong." And that was a tremendous healing because I had been, like, as I said, disowned by my family, and that I had a place that I could be included back again was tremendous for me. And it was through that that I started to study with his movement and ultimately enter the seminary. And by the way, I'm no longer married to that same man, but we're friends, and I understand God's circuitous ways of bringing people back. I think Jewish renewal is all about Keruv, ultimately. It's really about bringing people back in a very, very broad and wide tent.
Why Boulder?
It's a really funny story. I moved out to Boulder in my disenfranchised years when I was running away from Yiddishkeit. I was very young and was going as far away from anything Jewish that I could. And that was involved in all kinds of things. And at a certain age, probably around I turned 30, and was getting serious in a marriage and became pregnant. And I realized that that all my meditation cronies, under their names of Shanti and
Ramdas, Louis Ginsberg from the Bronx.
It is well known that the Buddhist community in America, even the most conservative Buddhists in America, are very large percentage Jewish. So there were Jews that came out of the woodwork when Reb Zalman started to give his lectures and teachings.
And so is it accurate to describe the scene as a host of, this was what years, more or less?
Reb Zalman came in to Boulder, I believe it was in 1995, 96.
95, 96.
Mm-hmm.
And so is it fair to say that these are kind of disenfranchised Jews having dabbled in Buddhism and a bunch of other traditions escaped to Boulder to not be in the shtetls of New York and Philadelphia and Los Angeles or wherever Jews used to congregate, and then found this spiritual guide? Did it take Boulder to achieve that? I mean, was it the sense of kind of freedom that could happen only outside of traditional confines of Jewish congregations?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think there was an element of freedom that was part of the equation that made it all okay.
So you've traveled far and wide. You've gone to many shuls, Renewal and others. What's special about Boulder? What's the Boulder spirit?
Boulder is infused with gorgeous environmental avira. There is a sense of these looming flatirons, beautiful, jutting, very angular mountains that stick up. You can see it from almost any spot in Boulder. And it calls to people who love nature, who care about nature, environmentalists, rock climbers, marathon runners, cyclists, yogis, because there is such a beautiful environmental frame. Many times, if the weather permits, we daven out of doors and we go outside to do our meditations, or we have Kabbalat Shabbat in the park.
We rarely do that on Amsterdam and 105th Street.
Right.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Journey Across America wouldn't be complete without a stop in your living room. We put a call out for listeners to tell us about their hometowns and communities, and here's what we got.
Hi, I'm Lauren Trexler. I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida, and all my life, whenever I go somewhere else, people are like, there are Jews in Tallahassee. I'm like, there are a lot more than you think. Granted, most of them are my relatives. My great great grandparents, them and their contemporaries, founded the temple there. My family's been there forever. My mom used to joke that she couldn't date anybody in Tallahassee because they were all her relatives. But I've lived in a lot of places since Tallahassee, including the very, very random place of Casper, Wyoming. And I've lived in a lot of places and a lot of places that I've been a pretty good Jewish community, but it was a very eye-opening experience, even being from Tallahassee to Wyoming. And I should add that I ended up going to HUC, and now I'm an educator at a synagogue in Akron, Ohio, just outside of Cleveland, which is pretty Jewish. But I always say that, like, if I hadn't grown up in Tallahassee, Florida, I don't think I would be where I am today, because I was super involved with youth group. I went to Jewish summer camp. And I think all the things that made me feel really Jewish growing up was because I felt different and unique. I'm from a place and lived in a lot of places that aren't necessarily quote unquote Jewish, but pretty freaking Jewish. I've always carried that with me, and being Jewish in America isn't just being from New York, Chicago, or LA.
Yes, my name is Judy Wolf. I was born and raised in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, a steel town that at one time had 7 synagogues that were packed every day, every holiday and Shabbos, and there are 9 Jews left in McKeesport. Now, that's pretty sad. There are some more in a suburb close to it. But what's unusual is a documentary was made about called Missing McKeesport, and it's very, very like so many communities in the Midwest that have, we all have memories. We have wonderful, wonderful memories, but they're socioeconomically depressed at this point, and the Jews have left. But we came back together for a reunion. And there's so many other communities all over Pennsylvania, all over Illinois, all over Michigan that were Jewish communities and are no longer.
Up next, we're heading to Tulsa to get a look at a vibrant Jewish community in the heart of America. We talk with Rabbi Mark Fitzerman and his kids, Micah Fitzerman Blue and Nina Fitzerman Blue. Have a listen.
Okay. Hi, my name is Mark Fitzerman. I'm one of the rabbis at Congregation B'nai Amun in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
My name is Micah Fitzerman Blue. I live in Los Angeles, California. I work as a screenwriter, and I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi, my name is Nina Fitzerman Blue. I am a Tulsa native. I am the younger child of Rabbi Mark Boone Fitzerman of Congregation B'nai Amuna and a social worker named Alice Blue. My older brother is Micah Fitzerman Blue, and we are Tulsa committed and loving. I don't know if that was good.
Tulsa is like the idealized mid-sized American city. Growing up in Tulsa, it had, you know, one of every good thing. So it had the one place I like to go, you know, shop for music. It had the one good bookstore. It had sort of one of each. And of course, that's now changed. It's expanded mightily since I left.
I'd love for people to come by the synagogue, but there's an active, this will sound so minor, but it's so important to me, an active coffee house culture in Tulsa. So just before this interview, I came from one of my favorites, Double Shot. There are a million people there. I have many of the meetings that used to take place in my office in places like that. I like the pedestrianization of life in Tulsa. I can walk there. Other people walk there. It feels like a place quite different from the place I came to.
And it's always been a place I loved growing up, and it's always been a place that I secretly really wanted to come back to. And I was able to convince my husband and my husband's family to come back here to raise our daughter. So it was very thrilling to be able to come home again.
When Nina and Dan decided to move back to Tulsa, it did not surprise me in the least. Nina was born in Tulsa. I was born in Kansas City, so her roots go even deeper. How she pronounces certain words remind me of that every time she says spoon as opposed to spoon. And my dad used to, from the front seat of the Volvo, he would say spoon. And Nina would call back spoon. And my dad would say spoon. And Nina would say spoon.
Everyone's first question, are there Jews in Tulsa? At the height of Jewish population in Tulsa, there might have been 3,500 Jews in this community. And my guess at this point is that we're at about the 2,000 person mark. The numbers, though small, don't really give you a sense of what it's like to live in this community.
I've always felt a very strong connection to Tulsa. I loved growing up here. I loved being part of a very tight-knit Jewish and liberal community. And I found, you know, having gone other places since my adolescence, that that's not always the case to have such a strong, tight-knit community of both Jews and like-minded political community members.
I think people have the idea that this is a red state bastion. And the truth is that there are lots of progressive people in Tulsa and Oklahoma City and other centers in the state. We have the seventh largest LGBTQ center in the country. The city is very hospitable when it comes to differentness of any kind. And there's a real appetite for progressive politics and progressive urban planning.
I think something that's really unique about the Tulsa Jewish community is that it participates so actively in the larger Tulsa community, and does a lot and plays a big part in, you know, helping those who are less fortunate and making sure that there's a strong, you know, Oklahoma is an extremely red state, and there is a strong contingent of activists. And I'm proud to say a lot of that activism comes through and with huge participation from the Jewish community in Tulsa. And I think that that's definitely unique. I think in bigger cities, there's often an impulse to serve our own community as Jews. And I think that Tulsa is pretty unique that it's more outward facing.
People imagine this as a forgotten provincial town. I find these Jews very loving, but also very sophisticated. They're well-traveled. They're well-educated. I learn a lot from them. And I feel supported in some of the interesting things that I think a congregation can accomplish. They also have a flexible idea of what rabbis can do and who rabbis are. I write a lot on, I published a book called The First Men's Guide to Ironing in one slice of my career in Tulsa, and that seemed to bring pleasure to the congregation as opposed to disapproval or discomfort. The congregation did me the favor, did our family the favor of allowing us to raise our kids in the way we thought best without some of the strictures that fall on rabbis in other, maybe more traditional communities. I like to think of my kids as free-thinking Jews who are not bound by the commitments that I made for myself, but who are very connected to Jewish life and are marking out their own path.
One of the most interesting things, and the thing that was so meaningful for me as a Jewish child in Tulsa, was, you know, being one of the few. For the most part, my friends were not Jewish because the Jewish community is small and mighty, but small. So I was often a Jewish representative in whatever situation I was in. So I had to be really knowledgeable about the holidays and what Jewish thought was. So I was always kind of felt like I was a representative of Judaism. And I felt like that was a unique and pretty powerful role as a young kid. I mean, this is part of being feeling like a minority. There were multiple experiences where well-meaning other young people told me that I was going to hell because I didn't believe in Jesus. And then they would quickly follow with, but I'll pray for you, which I always felt was very nice of them. You know, like they clearly liked me or else they wouldn't pray for me. I mean, they could have just left me in hell.
I think of Tulsa as a bit of a whetstone. I felt myself different from Tulsa a lot growing up. And I felt like that friction between me and Tulsa made me sharper. Growing up in Tulsa and feeling like you're not what everyone else is, it forces you to be an observer. It teaches you early that you're a little on the outside, and you begin to read the social cues and read the codes and unpack what is unsaid in a way that I feel like is part of what I do all the time as a writer, which is try to step outside people's experiences, see them, and then climb back in and write them truthfully.
That was Rabbi Mark Fitzerman of Tulsa and his kids, Micah Fitzerman Blue and Nina Fitzerman Blue. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or call us at 914-570-4869. Get your Unorthodox shirts, mugs, and stickers at bit.ly/unorthoshirt. Follow us on Instagram at @unorthodoxpodcast and on Twitter at @unorthodox_pod. Our show is produced by Josh Cross and Shira Talishkin. It is edited by Noah Levinson. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Thanks to everyone who participated in our special Jews Across America episode. We recorded this at Argo Studios, which will never give up its seat on the Supreme Court, and also at Crosstown Studios, which is packing up and moving to France. We're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends, and happy birthday, America.